ahead, a quartet of stormtroopers intersects her, then keeps moving down a perpendicular hallway. To the side, a few serving girls hide in an alcove, watching, waiting, frightened. In the quiet, if she listens, Adia can hear the sounds of the crowd outside. A dull rush, like blood in the ears. She wonders how long it'll be before someone breaches the walls. Maybe even clambering up through the broken tower, the one shattered by the laser turret. No time to worry about that.
Focus on the present problem, she thinks.
The palace map hovers in the air before her, a small holograph. She splays her fingers out, and the map grows larger, and she touches an area to zoom in. The captive pilot had to have left the room, and then... no ductwork to speak of. Everything is open and obvious. Big halls and staircases. The problem isn't that everything is open. The problem is that the palace is so large. It would take her a full day just to walk every centimeter of it. Up, down, all around. He could be hiding anywhere. And what's this? Here. A fragment of a passage behind the walls. Flickering. A secret passage? Or the start of one? Adia realizes they're dealing with an incomplete map. The satrap has furnished them with a map that fails to show the clandestine passages. Movement from her right. Someone runs fast, catches her shoulder, spins her around. She cries out as the small blaster she keeps in the holster right at the base of her spine is snatched away. The captive stands only a meter away with her pistol in his hand. Captain Wedge Antilles. His hair a muss, eyes unfocused. His pallor is the color of ash, greasy and slick with sweat.
That holoscreen, he says. I need it.
No,
she says, lifting her chin, trying to look tough.
See this blaster? I need that screen, and I need you to open comm channels. You can do that, can't you?
Her mouth forms a flat, resolute line.
No.
You're lying.
What if I am?
He laughs, exasperated, tired. He's in pain. He says,
I want you to think about this really hard. All this. The Empire? It's over. This is the end. You helped me, and I won't forget that. Nobody here has to know. Say I overpowered you. You don't look like a soldier or an officer. Do the smart thing. Help me. Give me that screen.
Hesitantly, she nods. Whimpering, she leans forward, starts to hand him the screen. He reaches for it.
Adia sneers and turns the screen toward him, sliding up her thumb along the side to jack up the brightness all the way so that the projector lights shine right in his eyes. He shields them, crying out.
Adia doesn't run. She thinks,
this is my moment. I capture him. I earn favor with Sloane and the others. I fix her mistake. I'm a hero.
She launches in, knees him in the gut. Her hands lash out, catch his wrist, and she gives it a twist. She's practiced in self-defense, having trained in the Imperial martial arts, a combination of Savat, Ichani, and good old-fashioned ice, Imperial combat exercises. The same training that every stormtrooper and officer gets. The blaster drops out of the pilot's hand. But Wedge, he's fast. Even in his condition, his other hand stabs out, catches the drop blaster. She drives her head forward, catching him right in the nose with the flat of her skull. He cries out. The blaster goes off, and pain fires through her. Adia staggers back. In her left leg, a hole from the blaster smokes. Wisps of smoke coil upward from the wound. Her whole leg goes numb, and she tumbles to the floor. The rebel scum says,
I'm sorry. I am.
Then he scoops up the holoscreen and hobbles off. Adia cries out, calling for help, screaming that the interloper is here. And then she just crumples up and cries because she failed. Her chance to do right by the Empire has gone so very wrong. Jazz stands at the doorway to Temin's shop. The journey here was not an easy one, though it should have been. A Kievan stream past. Some of them are carrying signs. On the way here, she saw an effigy of the satrap. Out there, right now, a clumsy scarecrow that looks like the dark imperial enforcer Darth Vader. Someone sets it on fire, and it burns. Black smoke rising from underneath. Fire consuming the Sith Lord Scarecrow. This city is a keg of cordillium about to go boom. She didn't make this happen, but she and the others definitely measured out the fuse and handed out matches. Part of her is proud. This is her operating at a much higher level. This is Jazz wielding an entire city population as a weapon against her target. She's used to manipulating people, but this is magnified. This is something sublime. The other side of it is, she's so used to working alone. Auntie Sugi always had a crew, not to mention a soft spot for the downtrodden. Farmers and slaves and fools. Jazz always figured that for weakness. Maybe it wasn't. She looks behind her. Inside the shop, Nora and Sinjir work together. The boy Temin had to make a side trip. He said he didn't keep his maps in the shop, just in case. Had to go to his hidey-hole nook and cubby. His words, not hers, to get them. So he and his lunatic droid went off.
I'm using these people to accomplish my goals.
That's what this is, isn't it? They're not her crew. They're tools. Same as any Hydro Spanner or Harris Wrench. That's what she tells herself to harden against their loss. Because smart credits say that someone won't survive this mission. They already almost lost Nora. Another will fall. She tries to ignore how that makes her feel. She tries to ignore that it makes her feel anything at all.
This is a job. You hold no allegiance to the New Republic or to this particular pack of freaks and deviants. They are not your people. You are not their people. Get the work done, get paid, get out.
That's what her head tells her. But why does her heart tell her something else? Here we go, Nora says, bringing up a box and plunking it down on the table. Sinjir leans over, sees what she's bringing up, then backpedals away.
That is an entire box of thermal detonators.
I didn't think they were snow globes.
Can I trust you not to blow us up? You handle those things like a dock worker dropping off a case of potted bantha meat.
She laughs. He frowns as she sizes him up and says,
You weren't a soldier, were you?
All are soldiers in service to the Empire,
he says wryly.
Uh-huh. I mean frontline soldier. Gun up, taking blaster fire. Look, thermal detonators don't go off until you activate them. She picks up the box and gives it a shake. He winces, waiting to be blown to his constituent molecules. They don't go boom if you jostle them. I could kick one and it wouldn't go off. Until you prime them, these things are basically just shiny rocks.
He clears his throat.
You'll forgive me if I stay a few meters away from that box of shiny rocks at all times, then.
Just trust me. We're safe.
But now she stops and folds her arms. He can see she's got something on her mind.
Go on. Say it. Unburden your soul. Spill it, Nora.
You can trust me. Can I trust you?
With thermal detonators?
With my life.
Oh, that.
He arches his eyebrows so high he expects it's hovering above his hairline.
You mean because I was an Imperial?
The Empire doesn't do betrayal very well. Its people are loyal because they know what happens if they're not. I'm your enemy, and you're mine. That kind of thing isn't easy to shake.
He snaps his fingers.
See, there. You're right, but you're also wrong.
Those loyal to the Empire are loyal because they know what will happen to them if they betray it. That much is true. And do you know why that is, Nora Wexley? That's because of me. I was a loyalty officer. Are you aware of the responsibilities of an Imperial loyalty officer?
I confess that I'm not.
Oh, it's a truly charming role. I was trained to sniff out weakness in my cohorts. I learned how to read body language, how to detect lies, how to use people against one another. All in order to discover where my own people had committed trespasses against the Empire. Anything from small breaches of conduct to outright treachery against the throne. I was the shadow they couldn't shake. You put me in a base or a battle station or office, and they knew they were on notice. I'd scare up what they'd done like a hunter flushing prey from the brush. And I'd hurt them to earn a confession and correct the errors.
Oh, it wasn't just physical pain I caused.
Though that was certainly a part of it. It was emotional pain. Can I tell you a story? Temin's not yet returned, so have at it. He leans back against a table. As he tells the story, his long, nimble fingers gesture along with it. Most of the people I hurt were people I didn't much care for. Some were brutes, others were cowards, and all of them were people I was happy to hobble on behalf of the Emperor. But that wasn't always the case. Take, for example, young gunnery officer Rilo Tang. Rilo, an eager officer, eyes bright like polished credits. A beautiful man, pretty like a sunrise, sweet like a jiff cake. And sneaky like a monkey lizard.
I don't follow.
He was a thief, you see.
What did he steal?
Sinjir laughs and cocks his head.
Oh, well, that's the thing. Nothing particularly important. It was a compulsion of his, I suspect. Grabby hands, picking up anything that wasn't nailed down. Mostly he stole the personal effects of others. Silly things. Hollow picks and ID tags and... By the stars, one time I remember he stole a private's pair of shoes. Why do that?
Nora narrows her eyes.
I'd ask the same. Why?
Best guess, given his psych profile? Parents often sent their troubled children to the Imperial Academies, an act meant to be corrective, as they assumed we could shape their sloppy, insubordinate progeny into something resembling a proper galactic citizen.
The reality was, often, that those types washed out. Forcibly so.
The Empire wanted its own heroes, not its own freak show.
I suspect Rilo was like that. What happened to him?
We warned him. I warned him. Again. And again. And then one day he stole something from a moth. A ring. A ring the moth said was personal to him, meaningful, but I realized had encoded information in its scroll work, though that's a story for another day.
So I was forced to deal with Rilo in order to solicit his confession.
There. That look on Nora's face. Up until now, she'd been following along with curiosity. But suddenly, that look falls away like bark off a dead tree. What's left is a cold, empty stare. One of horror.
You killed him,
she says.
No, 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 no. You misread me. I wasn't the executioner. I was the confessor. The secret police. I found the evidence... Then someone else signed the warrant, and someone else beyond that pushed you out of the airlock. Or hanged you, or put you in front of a firing squad. Or... But to elicit that confession, I had to break many bones on this beautiful boy's body. I don't know if they killed him. I heard rumors he ended up working the trash compactors. What matters is that his face would never look the same. His beauty, his vigor, gone. And that was my fault. You were a bad man. Still am, maybe.
though I'm trying to do better. But that's not why I'm telling you this story. The reason I'm telling you this is that you think you're my enemy. And that's not true. Not at all. The Empire is my enemy. The Empire has always been my enemy. I hunted my own kind. I hurt them. I was made to doubt them, to see the weakness in them. And I saw so much weakness and ruination in them, and in myself. They were my enemy then, and remain my enemy now. I've just scrapped the uniform. So you're with us now. You're a rebel? That thought twists inside of him. He is, isn't he? A rebel. He's turned, like milk past its time, gone to the other side. And why? Because he almost died there on Endor? Because looking at all that wreckage jarred him? Changed him? What a curious reason to desert your post. It can't be that simple. It can't be that complete. He tells himself that it's temporary, that this crisis of conscience will one day resolve itself. He lifts his chin and stares down his nose at her. He says, "I'm not with them, but not with you either. I'm with me."
"I don't trust people who are only in it for themselves."
He shrugs and offers a sad smile. "Then you shouldn't trust me." Everything's gone supernova. John Burrell can see that. TIE fighters blowing each other up overhead. The city surging all around him. He hides in the sliver-sized alleyway between two buildings, an old coffee shop and a rotten-walled tenement, and watches it all unfold. The anger, the chanting, rage at the Empire, fury for the satrapy, and a Kievan resurrection. Rebirth, blooming bright in the fires of revolution. Up until now, he had a goal. Get to a comm station, find a way to report in. He could hack it, or force the Imperials to give it up. But all these people around him? This small rebellion unfolding before his very eyes? Well, that puts him in the fighting spirit. He thinks back to that turbo laser turret, blasting apart whoever was in that rogue TIE fighter. That thing's a danger. So Jom changes his orders. Time for a new target. Forget the comm station. He plans on taking the turret. Single-handedly. Or the likelier result, he'll die trying. But if he wasn't willing to die for what he believes in, he wouldn't have joined the Rebel Alliance in the first fragging place. Temin's back now. All of them gather downstairs in the shop's cellar, and he has the maps of the city's subterranean passages spread out across a couple of weapons crates.
"A flimsy-plast map," Sinjir says. "How quaint."
Nora shushes him. She admits it sounds a bit sharp, a bit too motherly, and her feelings about him ricochet around the room of her mind like a stray blaster bolt. She wants to trust him, but something about him rubs her wrong. Could he betray them? Would he? Still, it works. Sinjir quiets down, and Nora leans in.
"Look, this is our way into the palace. The tunnels connect all parts of the city. The access points have long been walled off."
Temin interrupts.
"Yeah, which also means they've walled off the way into the palace."
"Maybe not," she says. "Everybody here has heard rumors of how the satraps sneak in and out of the palace. This might be how. And even if it is walled off, that's why we bring the detonators."
The bounty hunter nods.
"I like it."
Nora feels an odd surge of pride there. Jazz seems a hard one to please.
"It gets us off the streets and out of the way of the rebellion. Plus away from the prying eyes of both the Empire and any of Surratt's men. This works. And that's our doorway in?"
Jazz points to the secret door behind the Volacord.
"Yeah,"
Temin says.
"But I gotta say, I don't like this plan. It sucks. It sucks the fumes from a broken speeder bike. It sucks the vapor from the hindquarters of a gassy Eope. It sucks...
Evocative, Sinjir interrupts. You should have been a poet.
I'm just saying. Look, this map? It's not going to be totally accurate. This is hundreds of years old.
Nora says,
But you've explored the area. You'll be our guide. I trust you, Temin.
She offers a warm smile. To her surprise, he gives one back.
Okay, yeah, I have, and the map has been wrong a lot of the times. Plus, I didn't go that far. If we're going all the way to the palace, we have to pass by the old droid factory.
Which is where you got a lot of your droid parts to sell, right?
Not exactly. I picked scrap from the garbage pits down there. Holes full of junk from the factory. I never went to the factory itself.
Jazz asks,
Why not?
He hesitates, but then says,
Because it's haunted.
A moment where they all share looks. Sinjir cannot contain himself, and finally bursts out laughing.
Haunted? By what? Droid ghosts?
Nora elbows him hard in the ribs. He oofs.
I don't know,
Timon says.
I don't know, that's just the story. That's the story of why they sealed it all up. It was haunted, so they sealed it all up. You know how many people have gone missing down there?
They went missing because they didn't have a map,
Nora says.
They probably got lost, Temin, or never went missing at all, and are just part of the stories. Spooky stories from some Jungle Scout camping trip do not reality make. This is our best, fastest way there.
Jazz turns to Temin.
Do you have a better way?
She asks.
I do.
And?
We don't go at all. Listen, I get it. We all want to do right by the galaxy. But this isn't our job. Well,
he points to Jazz.
Fine, it's your job. But the rest of us? This is going to shake out with or without our help. And maybe the New Republic are the good guys, maybe they're not. Maybe nothing changes here. Maybe it even gets worse. We are the Outer Rim. We're the part of the toilet bowl nobody wants to clean, okay?
Sinjir whistles.
And I thought I was cynical.
Nora kneels before her son and takes his hands in hers. Her heart breaks to see him like this. He is cynical. She understands it. She knows it. And she's pretty sure it's her fault. Which means it's her job to fix it.
Tem,
she says,
this is the kind of thing your father and I have fought for. We want to make a better galaxy. For you. For your kids.
He winces at that, and she remembers that no teenager wants to talk about getting married and having a litter of puppies.
Please, trust me on this one. We're doing the right thing. And we can make a difference. Even a small group of people can change the galaxy. It only takes one man to spit in the eye of a giant and blind him. So let's do it. Let's spit in the giant's eye.
Jazz speaks up and says,
Your mother is right. If we don't act now, it's likely that the Imperials at that palace will squirm out of our grip. If that happens, we don't get paid. You want to get paid, don't you?
Temin nods.
I do.
Nora almost regrets that. That what moved the needle with him wasn't her earnest plea, but rather the practical greed-driven entreaty put forth by the bounty hunter. But it works. He's in. The call goes out, and they find Wedge Antilles in the servile quarters in the bottom floor of the palace. Already here, they're bringing steel shutters down over any of the stained glass windows and fortifying the doors. Down at this level, the roar of the crowd is a living thing. Still muted, muffled, but with the rise and fall that Rey can feel in her breastbone. She steps into the bunk room with a trio of stormtroopers behind her. Adia is not present. She's already under the care of the palace doctors. Antilles is face down at the back of the room. Dead.
His arm is splayed out, his hand curled into an arthritic claw. A few centimeters away, the holoscreen he stole from her assistant after he shot her. Ray eases forward, and then she sees his back gently rising and falling. He's not dead after all, merely unconscious. The pain and injury too great for him. Good. That means this particular breach began and ended before the others of the summit could find out. She signals the stormtroopers to gather Antilles up. Take the captive back upstairs. Use actual chains this time. Surely the satrap can conjure up some in this archaic palace. Then she snaps her fingers. Hand me that holo screen. I should return it to Adia. Just because she's injured doesn't mean she can't work. Ray needs her. The stormtrooper hands over the holo screen. And her blood goes cold. On it, a communication screen. He hacked their channel and secured a line. And it's open to a rebel frequency. Antilles sent out a summons to war.
Interlude. Theed, Naboo.
The red-headed boy with the cleft lip stands there with the other kids. Kids of all shapes and sizes, all ages and alien races. Most of them are younger than him. And the younger the kid, the more attention that kid gets from the wannabes who gather around, looking to adopt. All of them shipped here from various parts of the galaxy. The boy leans over to the tailhead girl next to him, and he says,
"We're never gonna go home with any of these people."
"Shut up, Iggs,"
she says.
"You're being a huge bummer."
He shrugs.
"I know it and you know it, Streaks. They want the kidlings, the young ones. We're too old."
"We're not that old,"
she whispers.
"And besides, we're heroes."
"Heroes?"
He rolls his eyes.
"Come on. They don't know that. And if they did, they wouldn't see it that way."
"We were the Ankle Biter Brigade from Coco Town. That means something."
"It means two things. Zip and squat. People don't even know what we did. You think people care about a bunch of orphans who hid in the sewers and messed with the Bucketheads and other Imperials? I don't know if you noticed, but we aren't on Coruscant anymore. And even if we were, so what?"
They got scooped up and brought here. Taken out of harm's way, so they were told. But Iggs and Streaks, they were the harm's way. They and the other orphans were doing rebel work, striking from the shadows, hiding in alleyways and shipping containers. They brought down a whole Imperial frigate, one resupplying the Empire's front lines.
"They care. We did more than that. We passed messages, told them about troop movements. We gave them intel, Iggs. How do you think the rebels retook Coco Town? That was us."
He waves her off.
"I know that. You know that. But these people will never know. Or never care."
Her face sinks.
"You think?"
Suddenly he feels bad. He squeezes her arm.
"We always got each other. And the others?"
Now the lady with the green skin and the older woman, the Maven, the one who has been talking to orphans and the wannabe parents about this or that, comes closer. Iggs hears the green lady talking to a pair of well-to-do humans, pink skins and fancy clothes. They're talking about how important it is to try to get the galaxy back to normal. About how a lot of poor kids have been displaced because their parents went to war or were casualties in this conflict or that battle, and it's time to put families front and center again. And mostly Iggs, he just stands there making faces, rolling his eyes, all while Streak stands there, vibrating visibly.
"Maybe they'll come and interview us,"
she says.
"Maybe we'll go home with someone today."
He hears the hope in her voice, like she wants to say, "Maybe we can have parents again."
"They won't come talk to us. We look like dirty urchins."
"They might."
"They won't."
But sure enough, here they come, the Green Lady and the Maven. The adults hunker down, and the Green Lady says to the both of them,
"What are your names?"
They tell her. He's Iggs, she's Streaks. The woman can't quite contain her amusement, a little smirk on her face.
Laugh it up,
Iggs thinks. She makes small talk with the kids, just dumb stuff. Their favorite flavor of milkshake, if they hope the grab ball pennant will start up again this year, stuff like that. A small crowd of wannabe parents gather now. Wealthy Naboo types in their finery and fanciness. Iggs only feels more like a stain on a nice tablecloth.
What happened to your parents?
The woman asks. Igg freezes. He doesn't want to think about it or even say it. He tries to block out the memories of seeing his two fathers lying there like that. Streaks, though, she jumps right in.
My parents were rebels. Their transport was attacked just past Tanis. And I'm a rebel, too. Me and Iggs here were part of a crew of kids called the Ankle Biter Brig...
Ugh, no. He feels out of place. A piece of trash left on a nice shelf. So while they're talking to Streaks, he ducks away behind a tent. He starts looking for ways out of here. Already, he starts forming a plan in his head. Find the sewers. They gotta go somewhere. Work their way back to the center of Theed. Find a spaceport. Catch a ride back to the action. Back to the hot war of Coruscant. Home to Coco Town, where the Ankle Biter Brigade can ride again and help the rebels. There. A grate. That'll do. Doesn't look bolted down. It's all gilded and pretty. Like everything in this city of museums. Iggs ducks back around the side of the tent. He's about to yell to Streaks that it's time to go. Time to bust out of here and forget all this getting adopted nonsense. But he turns around and she's gone. No, not gone. There, a few meters away, talking to a nice-looking couple. A clean pair of pink skins with good hair and shiny teeth. She looks happy. They look happy. Iggs thinks, good for her. Good for her. Then, because nobody's paying attention, he slinks off alone. He finds that drain grate, pops it, and ducks down into the darkness. It's time to go home. It's time to go back to the fight.
Chapter 29. The case is light. Though he's moved it before, it surprises him again. The crate with the black carbon locks looks like it should weigh a ton, and one might expect a weapon like this, or whatever this is, would be heavy. But it isn't. It's light as air, hollow as a balloon. As the others move into the passageway leading into the catacombs beneath the city, Temin lifts his end and Bones lifts the other. The droid helps not because the crate is heavy, but rather because it's cumbersome. They get it inside the door. Temin looks at his shop, says a small and silent goodbye, then shuts it. Ahead, Syngier snaps out the Illumidroids, little floating lanterns, each with a trio of tentacle arms dangling beneath, arms that dead-end in pincer grips. The light from the droids is mottled, greasy. They're dirty and dinged up. But it's enough. Nora and Syngier forge ahead. Temin starts to follow, but Jazz catches his arm first.
"This crate,"
she says.
"Surratt's weapon,"
he says. He tries to say it with some authority. Like, "Yeah, this is Surratt's, and I stole it. What of it?"
"It's not a weapon."
"What?"
"Yes, it is." "Maybe it can be, but it isn't literally a weapon."
"I don't understand. How did you..."
He touches one of the carbon locks, and it springs open. His eyes widen.
"What? What? I've been trying to open these for days. For days!"
"I picked them."
"You just picked them? Do you have magic fingers? Are you some kind of wizard?"
I have talents, and I used them while I was down here repairing my gun, before I helped your mother claim one of those TIE fighters for herself.
She gestures toward it.
Go on, pop it.
He does. Like a kid on his naming day, he rips into this present with greedy gusto.
Soon as the lid lifts, a blue glow emerges.
He has to squint against it, it's so bright. Then he sees it's a box of data cubes.
Data cubes?
He asks.
That's it? It's not a weapon at all. It's not. It's something far better. Information.
Surratt was protecting information?
I don't know about what. But if we get through this, I'll help you figure out what that information is. And then together, we can sell it.
Ah, there it is. There's a wrangle. He knew there had to be one. He clucks his tongue.
And I assume you get a cut. For your benevolence and wisdom and your connections to whatever market would buy this?
60-40.
Oh, whoa! Hey, that's not fair!
I'll give you the 60.
Oh.
He hesitates. Ahead, the light recedes as the others walk on, the Illumidroids bobbling after them. His mother calls.
Are you coming? Deal.
He tells Jazz, then he shakes her hand.
Deal.
And we're coming!
He yells. Under his breath, he adds.
So impatient.
Sinjir is used to tight spaces. The Empire was not known for its roomy architecture. It was fond of austere pragmatism. That term, austere pragmatism, or sometimes pragmatic austerity, found its way atop many Imperial brochures and propaganda tracts, and so kept its hallways low and narrow. Stormtroopers were literally supposed to be within the same range of height and weight, in part because of exactly that. He wasn't joking when he said he was too tall to be a stormtrooper. The catacombs as such do not give him claustrophobia, not strictly speaking. No, the anxiety in his chest is from something else, the way they wind around. It's not enough that the maze asks them to go right, left, or straight. Instead, some passages go up, others down, and others yet wind around in a spiral. One pathway will be dry as dust, and the smell coming out of it will be of pulverized bone. Another pathway will be wet, heady, almost fungal. They walk through puddles and over crumbling stone and mortar. Sometimes the Illumidroids highlight a wall as they pass, and the walls show off filthy handprints streaked across the rock, or instead show something in a language far off from basic. Some curse, perhaps, some profanity, or perhaps some threat. Occasionally sounds wind their way through the labyrinth, too. Scraping, scuffing, a hiss. Once, a pair of green eyes sat shining in the darkness like glowing crystals. When their light reached it, Sinjir saw it was just a Fangla, a pale, hairless vermin. High haunches and crooked incisors. It spits and hisses before scurrying off, claws clicking. They walk for a while, stopping sometimes to check the map. Then they continue on, walking underneath dripping water. Lingering rainwater, Temin assures them, not like the bodily excretions of some Ithorian doing his business up above. They cross a long, narrow bridge. Only halfway across it does Sinjir realize that it matches the battle droid, because the thing is mostly bones. Larger bones, not human, bound up with rusted wire. It sways over a chasm, and Sinjir remembers the great rift below him as he dangled there in Surratt Nuat's dungeon. A dungeon that must connect up to the city's underground space. Soon they start to see droid pieces and blaster scoring on the walls. Sinjir even thinks he sees scarring from lightsaber blades. This was the site of an old battle during the Clone Wars, when the Jedi were populous and not on the edge of extinction. Temin says,
"We're coming up on the junk pits."
The map says as much, Sinjir thinks. And then he watches Temin. He hadn't been, not really.
The boy seemed fine, if a bit shook up from all of this.
He can pretend he's hard against it, but between almost getting killed by a Sullustan gangster and losing his mother, it's to be expected that the boy is off his kilter. Something else is going on, though. It's in the way the boy looks around and fidgets. He's nervous, like he's hiding something. Temin has a secret. Sinjir hangs back and urges Jazz to hang back with him.
What is it?
She asks in a low voice.
We need to talk.
She says, nodding like this was inevitable.
I knew this would come. And yes, I concede.
You concede what, exactly?
You are satisfying.
I don't follow.
Satisfying? I don't know what that means. I do know that it sounds awfully milquetoast. Drinking a cup of protein slurry when you're truly hungry is satisfying, and yet disgusting. Jazz gives him a frustrated look.
I mean that I find you capable. You interest me. And so yes, when all this is over, we may couple.
Couple? Like...
His face goes suspiciously and surprisingly red.
Like you and me? Together?
That is indeed what I mean.
He laughs.
If you're going to laugh about it,
she says, suddenly stung,
then you can take my invitation and stick it in your exhaust port.
No, I just mean I'm not into this.
This?
Her scowl deepens and her teeth bare.
Aliens?
Women!
Oh. Oh.
Yes, oh.
Oh.
Moments pass. The awkwardness between them is a living thing. Like a cloud of flies you can't ignore, no matter how hard you try. Eventually, she blurts out,
You wanted to speak to me about something else, apparently?
Ah, yes, the boy, Temin.
He's clearly too young for you.
Would you stop? That's not what I mean. Listen, he's lying to us.
Everybody is lying all the time, Sinjir. I recognize that your former role in the Empire makes you excessively paranoid, but...
The map, he says, finally. It's about the map.
What about it?
Temin told us the map had changed, that it was wrong.
He sees the realization hit her. It lands on her the way a fly lands on someone's nose.
But it hasn't been wrong,
she says.
It's been right.
Exactly.
He's hiding something.
Her brow darkens.
Something down here he doesn't want us to see, perhaps.
A stash, maybe? A trove?
Could be. Keep your eyes peeled.
You too.
The junk pits, massive craters dug out of the catacombs. The stone brick gives way to natural rock, opening into chambers wide and deep that house heaps and mounds of old scrap. Droid parts mostly, and a great deal of it largely unrecognizable or unusable. The good stuff likely picked over and pulled out.
By my son,
Nora thinks. She stands by it, looking around. She kicks a stone forward.
It pings off what looks like a half-melted protocol droid arm.
Other parts clang and clatter, sliding down. A momentary avalanche of scrap scree. All of it echoes. Temin sidles up next to her.
There goes us being quiet,
he says.
We're alone down here.
You hope.
She rolls her eyes.
Where are the other two?
Mr. Bones stands about 3 meters back, still cradling the crate of thermal detonators while humming. But the other two aren't here.
They're back away, talking. I saw the light from their droid.
She wrinkles her brow.
Temin, do you trust Sinjir?
I don't know. Why?
He's an Imperial. He hurt people for a living.
You trust the bounty hunter, but not the Imperial?
She shrugs.
A bounty hunter lives by a certain code. They want to get paid, and this mission gets her paid. I trust her as far as all that.
But Sinjir, not so much.
I don't know. I want to trust him.
He got us this far.
That's true.
He hasn't fragged us over yet.
Language,
she chides.
Sorry.
And you're right. But we could be walking into a trap.
Timon tenses up and looks away. She sees now she's given him cause to worry.
They aren't family,
he says.
We're family.
We are. But I'm sure we'll be fine. It'll all be okay.
Yeah.
He thrusts his tongue in the pocket of his cheek and idly nudges a stone with his shoe.
Mom, I'm sorry.
For what?
He dithers a bit.
For being a real sleemo to you. It wasn't right. I just...
His nostrils flare as he draws a deep breath.
I missed you. And I missed Dad. And I was mad that you left. And then even madder that maybe you died, and I don't have what you have. I don't have the courage. I don't have that fire in my heart for the New Republic like you. I just...
She puts her arm around him.
It's okay. You're a kid, Tim. You got enough to worry about. Don't worry about this. I love you.
I love you too.
A flutter in her chest. She knows he loves her. But to hear it, it makes all the difference. From behind them, Jazz calls.
Are we stopping?
Nora answers.
No. Just waiting for the pair of you to catch up.
They keep on. It's time, Sinjir thinks, to pry. They walk past the junk pits toward the direction of what the map says is the old droid factory. Or its entrance, at least. Temin says they'll have to go right past the front of it, though thankfully not inside. As they pass by a wall of glowing fungus, the stone beneath their feet loose and slippery, slick with spongy moss, Sinjir catches up with Temin and his B-1 battle droid, Bones.
That droid of yours, Sinjir says. He's something.
Temin looks up, a dubious brow raised.
Yeah, I know.
You, find him down here?
Uh-huh. In one of the pits.
The battle droid saunters alongside, singing a quiet, well, not that quiet, little song.
He's obviously no longer standard issue, Sinjir says. You've done some modifications.
Thanks, Darth Obvious. Or is it Emperor Palpable? Next you'll tell me which end of a blaster is the shooty-shooty one, or why I wouldn't do so hot in a Wookiee arm wrestling league.
You can't outsnark me, boy, so don't even try.
I'm just saying, how exactly did you program that droid to be so... that? He gestures to the droid, who stops singing long enough to do a high kick. Temin sighs, as if this line of questioning bores him, and yet he must persevere.
Bones is primed with a high-octane cocktail of programs. Some heuristic combat droid programs, some martial arts vids, the moves of some Clone Wars cyborg general, and also the body map maneuvers of a troop of Lale dancers from Ryloth.
Dancers? That explains some things, actually. The occasionally graceful way the droid moves, but also the humming and singing.
Crafty, Sinjir says.
That's me.
What else is down here?
I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine.
That answer, it reads true. Temin doesn't appear to be lying, but as Sinjir just noted, the boy is crafty.
Is there something down here you don't want us to see, Temin?
What? Are you accusing me of something?
I just want you to know we're not going to... plunder your wares.
I don't have any wares down here to plunder.
Sinjir sniffs.
I thought perhaps you didn't want us getting to the droid factory treasure before you did. But that means it's something else.
What's something else?
You're hiding something, Temin. I can sense it.
There. There it is. Temin's whole expression shifts just slightly. There's a flicker on his face, like a disruption in a hologram. A sign that Sinjir is right. The boy is hiding something.
I'm not.
Ahead, Jazz says,
"The factory."
She points to the side. To Temin, Sinjir says, "To be continued." Then they jog to catch up, the little Illumidroid burbling a meter behind. Here, the passageway opens up. The droid factory entrance is a wide mouth framed by metal arches, two booths, an old corroded sign that says "Support the Confederacy of Independent Systems." Another sign says "Buy a droid from the Separatist Alliance." A third, hanging from above, at an angle, since one of the bolts has come free, says "Rally against Republic oppression." On that one, some of the letters are so rusted they've essentially gone missing. Nora says,
"This from the days when the Separatists brought the war to the Outer Rim in the later years of the Clone Wars."
"How'd they get the droids out?"
Jazz says.
"They didn't march them through these sewers."
Temin shifts his weight nervously. Sinjir watches him. The boy says,
"It used to be a telescoping platform. They'd raise the droids up for delivery and ships would pick them up. It's all destroyed, sealed over. I thought once you could get down here from there, but it's too wrecked."
He scratches his head.
"Can we go? This place gives me the hypers."
A small technique for rooting out truth is to make the subject, Sinjir actually thinks the word victim, but he tries to shove that kind of thinking back in the dark hole from whence it came. Uncomfortable. Put them off balance. Do that, they make mistakes. They say things they don't mean to say. And so that is Sinjir's plan of the moment. He picks up a hunk of stone.
"It's not haunted," he says. "Look."
Sinjir wings the stone toward the gate. It bongs off one of the booths. Rust flakes rain, and the stone drops.
"Don't!"
Temin cautions.
"There's nothing to worry about. The factory isn't..."
Inside, deep within the bowels of the factory, something howls. A mechanized sound. Not human. Maybe not altogether robotic, either.
"The gates,"
Jazz says.
"This place should be sealed up."
"But it's not," Nora adds. "Everything's open."
Another wail, and a third after that. Closer now.
"I have a bad feeling about this."
"We need to go," Temin says.
From inside the old factory, a sudden scramble of sound, metal on metal, like footsteps, coming toward them, and closing in fast.
"Run!"
Sinjir yells. Chapter 30. His red nostrils flare, air in and out. Akbar longs for water. He has a small tank here, a back-to-healing tank retrofitted with water possessing the salinity and pH balance of his homeworld, Mon Calamari. Sometimes he goes into it and just floats. But he has little time for such moments. Maybe one day, but not today. The message from Captain Antilles plays again and again in his mind. It came in on an Imperial channel, of all things. Akbar wasn't the recipient, but saw it soon after. Wedge looked ragged, injured. His message before he collapsed and the communications ended was brief. Too brief.
"High-level Imperial meeting. Blockade on... Akiva. Palace at Mira. Now is the..."
And then it was over. He tells the others, Augate, Madine, Mon Mothma, Ensign Deltura, that Antilles was right. Akbar presumes to finish the captain's statement.
"Now is the time. Prepare a small fleet, but have other ships in reserve, fueled up with full loadouts. Augate, I want you to lead the charge. Be ready for anything. If this is the Empire, you can be sure they will not go easily. And they are overly fond of tricking us into doing what they want.
It's like inverting a pyramid and carrying it point down on your back. All that weight. The sharp peak between your shoulder blades, built of bricks of blame. A terrible and uncomfortable burden. Sloane is feeling it now. The others are driven now by panic, rage, opportunity. Pandion trying to winnow her down to particulate matter. Shale, the doomsayer, who thinks they must surrender now or die soon. Tashu, interjecting now and again with some parable or pabulum about the wisdom of the dark side, and if only they followed its teachings, and oh, Palpatine said this, the old Sith writings said that. Crassus wants to buy their way out. He's waving around his metaphorical credits purse, thinking that the Empire can bribe its way free of New Republic persecution. Best of luck with that, Rey thinks. The satrap, at least, remains quiet. He sits in the corner, staring down at his hands. The writing is on the wall for that one. He knows the Empire will abandon him. He will be left with a city that seeks his head on a pitchfork so they can wave it around for all to see. In the other corner of the dining room, as they have never yet made it to the meeting room near their quarters on this troubled and turbulent day, stands Adia. Her leg already bound up in a foam layer cast printed by the medical droid. The assistant hobbles over, and Rey thinks, I must keep her close. She has shown more steel than most of these so-called Imperials. The yacht? Rey asks her, ignoring the shouts of vitriol from the rest of the room. Had to stop for fuel one system over, but in hyperspace now. We'll land soon after. Expected within the hour. Rey tenses up. That's longer than expected. I don't know if I can keep these animals at bay until then. They might tear my head off, too. Any chance Crassus is delaying it behind our backs?
Possible, but can't see why. He's eager to leave. Truth is, those big ugly barges are...
Here, Adia winces in a bit of pain and shifts her weight.
They guzzle fuel like it's free drinks at the Death Star Commissary.
Sloane spent plenty of nights drinking at the commissary with her comrades. A pang of nostalgia plucks her strings. Rey turns to the room. She makes her voice louder than everyone else's.
Shale, how long before we can expect a rebel fleet?
The woman scrunches up her face and frowns.
Hard to say, Admiral. They'll send something, probably soon. One suspects it'll be a reasonably sized fleet. We expect them within the hour, if they're feeling aggressive. 3, if cautious.
That's cutting it awfully close.
Our own Star Destroyers. It's time to call them back. Our ruse is over.
Shale objects.
Admiral, if we bring them back, we have no guarantee that those 3 destroyers will survive the ensuing battle.
Caution I admire. Cowardice I do not. Though our TIE regiment is reduced somewhat, our destroyers are more than capable of cutting down a rebel fleet, especially if we are ready for the fight. I don't want to make our escape into space, just as the rebel scum come dropping out of hyperspace.
To Adia, she says,
Call them back, now!
Yes, Admiral.
Adia leans in.
Also, you have a call.
Sloane mouths the question.
Who?
She tilts her screen toward the Admiral so that the rest of the room won't be able to see it. Rey sees a face she recognizes, though it belongs to someone to whom she has never been introduced. The Sullustan gangster, Surat Nuat. But why?
Chapter 31. Time, broken out into the moments between trigger pulls, Jazz drops to her knee and faces the coming horde as the others flee. The long rifle in her hand,
eye against its scope, down there, toward the entrance,
they pour out.
A flash of corroded metal, piston legs, dented chest plates, long, gangly, many-jointed limbs.
Droids, she thinks.
Mad lunatic droids, each different from the last. glowing eyes, mechanized whales. They rush down the passageway, some 30 meters off, surging forward like feral things, like the bristle-backed boar wolves of Endor, running on all fours, up the walls, skittering along the crumbling ceiling like spiders. The slug thrower launches round after round. They drop one by one. She takes the legs out from the first. It crashes down, neck breaking as it hits. A spark as the shot punches through the metal skull of one, and it tumbles into another of its swarm. They shriek and screech. She fires again, and one of their skulls pops off, clanging against the wall with a loud echo. That's when she sees. They're not droids. They're something else. Creatures. Black-eyed things. Noseless. Mouths open, showcasing a pincushion of wild needle teeth. The thing that loses its skull plate dashes to the side, grabs it, and reaffixes it before joining the rushing throng anew. 25 meters. 20. 18. Closer. Closer.
There's too many,
she thinks. A dozen here, and more pouring out of the factory. A whole tribe of these things.
A hive.
But she has the slugs. She can do this. But there, Aunt Sugi's voice whispering inside her ear.
You have to know when to run, girl.
That, a message to Jazz only weeks before Jazz took her advice. Maybe how Sugi meant it, maybe not. But she ran away from her home planet. A terrible place. A strange place, Iridonia. Brutal and unforgiving. 15 meters. Both her hearts beat fast in tandem, outracing the speed with which she can pull the trigger. 12 meters. They shriek and click and swarm. A hand at her shoulder. A voice numb and almost lost underneath the ringing in her ears. It's the boy.
We have to go, he's saying. There's too many. I can do this,
she roars. But she can't. She knows she can't.
You have to know when to run, girl.
Now is the time to run. The stories were true, Temin realizes, from a certain point of view. What came spilling out of that old droid factory weren't ghosts. The place wasn't haunted by specters or force wraiths. And it isn't haunted by old malfunctioning droids either. It's the Oogteen. When he goes back to get Jazz, he sees one. What they thought were droids were just the Oogteen wearing droid parts like armor. The pale, feral things, near humans but far enough to still be monsters, usually keep to the jungles and canyons. Sometimes, though, they find caves to live in. The catacombs beneath Mira aren't just caves, he realizes. They're a whole cave system. Maybe they connect out elsewhere, to the Canyon of Akar, or even all the way to the coastline far south. This pack has been living down here for a long time, hasn't it? It doesn't even matter now, because he and his friends are besieged, chased, and the monsters are gaining ground fast. Jazz turns suddenly. She fires a shot at a half-collapsed stone beam hanging above the passageway. One shot, it cracks, starts to splinter. Those cracks spread, but the pack is almost upon them, gibbering and screaming like men on fire. Again, Temin tries to pull her along, but she takes one last shot. The beam crashes down. Water streams along with it. It crushes the front line of the monsters. It slows them down. For a moment. They run once more, rounding a corner. Here it goes up. And he knows that they're nearing the ground underneath the Royal District. Another half-hour walk, and they'll be at or beneath the Satrap's palace. Mr. Bones skids to a halt. He sets down the box of detonators. His astromech arm spins up, blurring the air. His other arm snaps back, revealing the vibroblade. Bones makes sounds like the Oogteen, threatening howls, barks, gargled blasts of mechanical distortion. Temin yells at him, tells the droid now isn't the time. But Bones is programmed to protect Temin.
That is the programming that overrides all else. Fierce, loyal, psychotic. The Oog teens swarm up over the broken beam. Temin hears his mother calling for him. He tries to tell Bones to move, even pulling on the battle droid's arm. But he doesn't budge. Then he looks down, near the droid's feet. The box of detonators.
The box of detonators! I've got a plan!
He yells at Bones.
Come on! Come on!
He grabs one of the detonators out of the box. Just one. Then he pops it open, spins the top to its shortest fuse, and flings it back into the box from whence it came. Then he yells,
Run! Everybody, run!
Temin bolts forward, his legs straining, all parts of him tensing up as he waves everyone away. Bones sprints alongside of him, the droid's feet smashing hard into the brick. The battle droid yells,
I will go boom!
6 seconds, the Oog teens swarm. 5 seconds, Nora waves her son and the others on. 4 seconds, the droid-clad monsters rush up to the box. 3 seconds, Jazz pivots, fires her rifle over Temin's shoulder. 2 seconds, Bones cackles. 1 second, Temin winces and dives to the ground as... He lifts his face from the ground. His head pulses like the engine of an idling speeder bike. Temin pushes himself up on his hands, dust and rocky bits raining down from his hair. He flinches just in time to see Jazz leap forward and jam the butt of her gun into the faceplate of one of the Oog teen. A protocol droid face painted in what looks like blood, the mask rent in half with a jagged rip so it looks to be some nightmarish mouth. And the thing pinwheels and goes down. Bones stomps on it again and again. Temin thinks,
it didn't work. The plan didn't work.
But then he braces himself against the wall and pulls himself up. Jazz offers him a hand and he takes it. Two of the Oog teen lie on the broken floor. Here, the floor is crooked, sporadic tile, all of it shattered. The tunnel is sealed.
Stragglers,
Jazz says, gesturing toward the two monsters. Up close, he can see their pale flesh underneath the armor, revealed between the joints like the flesh of a krill crab when you turn it over to get at its meat.
You okay?
He nods numbly.
That was a good idea,
Jazz says, and then she quick steps out of the way as Nora launches herself at Temin, wrapping her arms around him.
It was a good idea,
Nora says. She kisses his brow. Idly, he thinks.
Even though I'm dirty?
That's what a mother does.
Thanks,
he says, that high-pitched tone still moving from ear to ear, his head still pounding like heavy rain on an old fuel drum. Sinjir steps up, dusting off his officer's uniform.
Let's not all crack open a case of fizzy drinks just yet. I'll casually remind you all that the boy just detonated our key into the satrap's palace.
Yes,
Temin thinks.
Now we'll have to turn back around and everything will be fine again.
We can't go back,
Jazz says.
Guess it's over,
Temin says with a shrug. He tries not to play it too eagerly.
It'll all shake out. We'll find a way back up to the surface and...
Sinjir lifts his head.
Way up to the surface? Can you find us a way out nearby?
Abso-fragging-lutely,
Temin says.
Language,
his mother says.
Oh, sorry. But, yeah, hold on.
He unrolls the map, his heart beating a kilometer a minute in his chest.
We're in the clear.
His second thoughts about everything no longer matter.
Here, close by. 5 minutes and we're there. Should take us right up into the old banking clan building.
Not us, Sinjir says. Me.
That earns him some quizzical looks.
I'm dressed for the occasion of duplicity,
he says, demonstrating his officer's uniform with an open-handed gesture.
I'll find a way up and out. I'll contact the Imperials at the palace. I should be able to find the frequency because... Oh, that's right. I was an Imperial with high-level clearance. And then I'll get them to open the door for us.
Jazz frowns.
And how do you plan to do that?
That is the brilliant part. I'll tell them the tunnels are their one safe way out of the palace.
Interlude. Tatooine.
Jawas stink. That's something Adwin Charu didn't expect. Most of this planet has that hot sand scent to it, like the inside of his mother's clay oven before she put dough into it, like everything's baking. But soon as he stepped inside this sand crawler, the odor hit him like a fist. A musky animal smell. And suddenly he's forced to wonder if each Jawa is just a fraternity of wet rats gathering together under brown robes and a black face veil. They hiss and jabber at him. And he tells them again, like he's been telling them for the last half hour, "I don't want any of this. This!" He sweeps his arms in a broad gesture, indicating the dimly lit heaps of junk all around him. "Is all worthless to me and my company. I need to see the real goods." He enunciates words like he's speaking to someone hard of hearing, as if it's doing any good at all. These stubborn little stink monsters don't seem to hear him, or understand him, or maybe they just don't care. But he knows the stories. They sell the dross to the rubes, but every sandcrawler has a real collection, too. Valuable goods to those in the know. Adwin has a job here. And it's not to come back to his boss with an armload of malfunctioning garbage. The Jawas click and whisper. "I need droids, weapons, mining tools. I know these sand crawlers are old mining vehicles. You stole them. Least you could do is..." From behind him, someone clears his throat. Adwin glances back, sees a man standing there. Angular fellow, leathery skin. Pinched eyes. Amused smile.
"Ahoy there," the man says.
"Aha," Adwin answers. "Fine. If you'll excuse me." Irritated, he adds, "I hope to be done here soon. Provided these things comply."
"You're not from around here, are you?"
the man says, still grinning like he knows something. He steps in out of the bright desert sun. Brushes some dust off his long jacket.
"Not local."
"No. How did you know?"
The man chuckles, a roomy, growly laugh.
"You're too clean, for starters. Spend some time here, you get dust all up in your fingernails and nose hairs, sand in your boots. But the other thing is, you gotta know how to handle the Jawas. These little scavengers, they work on rapport. You buy something now, something small, and you come back, and then you buy bigger. And eventually, after a dozen or so visits, you start to see what they really have on offer. The real goods."
Adwin scowls. He doesn't have the patience for this. "I don't have the luxury of time. My boss won't allow it." He sighs. "This is worthless, then. Well, I suppose I'll have to take my chances in... What's that town behind us?"
"Mos Pelgo,"
the man says.
"Yes, well, there or Espa, I suppose." Adwin sighs. He begins to push past the man. The man extends the flat of his hand. He doesn't touch Adwin, but does block his way out.
"Now hold on, friend. I happen to have the rapport you need with these little fellas. I'd be happy to vouch for you."
Adwin narrows his eyes.
"You would?"
"Sure thing."
"And why would you do that?" He squints harder, suspicion twisting his face into an uncertain sneer. "What's the price?"
The man laughs again.
"No price, no price. Just hospitality."
This planet. Back-end water farming bumpkins. Fine. Adwin can use that. He's comfortable exploiting the naivete of others.
"Yes, yes, that would be excellent. Thank you. Your name?"
"Cobb Vanth."
"Mr. Vanth."
"Cobb, please."
"Ah, Cobb. Shall we then?"
The man steps forward, scratching at his stubbled face. He starts talking to the Jawas. They gabble at him in their rat tongue, and he says,
No, I know, but I come bearing credits. So does he.
Cobb turns to Adwin and gives a wink. The Jawas whisper in battle.
Okay, then. Come on,
Cobb says, and they follow a pair of the little hooded weirdos to another door in the back, next to an upside-down gonk droid. The door hisses open, then shuts again behind them. Lights click on. Brighter here than in the other room, and sure enough, these are the goods. A protocol droid, a pair of astromechs, a rack of weapons. Imperial issue, by the looks of it. Against the far wall, a series of panels from what looks like a hut sail barge, plus a few other Huttese artifacts, some charred, others twisted, all of it wreckage. Perfect, perfect, perfect! Adwin says, clapping his hands. He immediately heads over to a shelf and starts looking through bins, boxes, wire crates. Cobb pokes around, too, though Adwin mostly loses track of him until Cobb says,
You're with that new mining company.
Adwin turns.
Oh, yes.
The Red Key Company, isn't it?
That's the one. How did you know?
I have a way of sussing things out. I know that things are changing. Not just in the galaxy, but here at home, too. The Huts still haven't shaken out who's next up to fill Jabba's throne. If you can call that flat slab of his a throne. Seems like this might be a new day for Tatooine.
Yes, we certainly hope so,
Adwin idly responds, mostly ignoring the man's small-talk prattle. He's happy Cobb got him in here, but now wishes the man would just leave him alone. Adwin spies a large, long box on the floor. He whips off the ratty cloth that's covering it, and... Oh, my. From the box, he withdraws a helmet, pitted and pocked, as if with some kind of acid. But still, he wraps his knuckles on it. The Mandalorians knew how to make armor, didn't they?
Look at this, he says, holding it up. Mandalorian battle armor. Whole box. Complete set by the looks of it. Been through hell and back. I think my boss will appreciate this.
I actually think I might take that home with me,
Cobb says.
I think not,
Adwin says, turning around, the helmet tucked under his arm. The blaster at his hip suddenly feels heavy, pendulous, eager to be drawn. A strange sensation, that. Adwin feels like he's really getting into the spirit of this planet. He's never had to shoot a man before. Maybe that day is today. An exhilarating feeling, oddly. Cobb grins, crosses his arms.
What are you thinking, company man? See, I could really use that armor. I figure being a newly appointed lawman.
Self-appointed, I think,
Adwin says. But Cobb doesn't take the bait.
Being a lawman, I could use some protection against those corrupt types who might think to seize the opportunity here on my planet. That armor is mine.
Adwin smirks. He takes his thumb and pulls back his tunic, revealing the blaster. Cobb, I...
Sheriff Vance to you.
Oh, Adwin laughs. Sheriff, I'd hate to have to draw this blaster.
Cobb Vance's hand is up in a flash. There's the shriek from his own blaster, and it punches a cauterized hole clean through Adwin's shoulder on his right side. His hand goes limp, lifeless. The helmet clatters out of his other hand. He backs against the shelf, terror-struck.
You monster!
Cobb shrugs.
Oh, now, I'm no monster. No worse than your boss, that weak-weight dung-muncher Lorgan Movellan. I know his scam. I know all the scams. Afraid the Republic is back and gonna put their boot down on all the lowlifes and scumlickers. The syndicates are trying to find new ways to appear legit. And with the Huts fighting one another for control, bunch of these little quote-unquote mining companies are swooping in with brutes like your boss at the helm. A new age of mining, Barons. Won't fly. I'm here now. Me and others like me. Bringing the law to this lawless place. And that starts with me shooting you and taking that armor out from under you.
Adwin whimpers.
Please! Don't kill me!
Oh, I'm not. I'm leaving you alive, so you can tell your boss that he'd best pack up and hit the hyperspace lanes out of this sector, lest he wants me coming for him. And my new, well, new to me, suit of armor.
I will!
Adwin says, sinking to the floor. He watches Cobb pick up the box of armor before heading to the door. On his way out, Cobb says,
Next time you want to pretend to be a gunfighter, best to shoot first. Talk later. Bye now.
Chapter 32. The rock crashes hard against the stormtrooper's helmet. The helmet spins and visibility is lost. John Burrell dances around to the front of the armor-clad Imperial and gives a hard kick upward. The toe of his boot catches the stormtrooper's blaster hand. The hand snaps back. The blaster leaves the grip and spirals forward. Jom catches it and fires three bolts into the stormtrooper's chest. The body drops atop the other three troopers. Jom's one broken arm still dangles at his side.
Not bad for a bird with a busted wing,
he thinks. He starts to climb up the ladder that leads up to the turbolaser ground-to-orbit turret. But as it turns out, climbing up the ladder is the hardest part. He has to lean into it, take it slow, haul himself up with one good arm. The stormtrooper's blaster rifle bolted onto his back. It's a miserable endeavor. Lots of grunts and growls. It takes what seems like a galactic epoch, but somehow he manages to get to the top and pop the hatch. He starts to climb inside.
Don't move!
Comes a voice. A young Imperial gunnery officer in his little officer's hat stands there. A small Imperial blaster pointed. That hand shakes just so. Jom sighs. He climbs all the way through.
Slowly!
As the Imperial warns him and lifts his one hand up to placate.
Both hands!
The officer says. He's a fresh-faced nobody. Cheeks like marshmallows, scared eyes like livestock about to meet its maker. The kid stands in front of the gunnery console. Through the glass, Jom can see the twin turbolaser barrels aimed heavenward.
One's broken, Jom says.
I said both hands!
Jom growls. Fragging kid. He winces as he lifts his broken arm. White-hot pain arcs across both shoulders. He bares his teeth and stares through watering, wincing eyes.
There.
Now, on your knees.
You're young.
What?
Young. Like a baby Wilk calf. Don't know a Wilk? I grew up on a farm. Long-legged critters. Meat tastes stringy, but the milk is good. And their hides make for fine leather. Their babies are clumsy, fumbling things. Knock-kneed and dumb as a box of retainer bolts. You're just a baby.
I am not!
The officer insists, gesturing again with the blaster.
Let me guess how it's been. Your top officers are mostly gone now. A lot of them up with the Death Star or the ensuing battles. Some got sold out by governors. So now the officer pool is either guys like you, who are really young and untested, or really old and are being brought back in from the pasture because they got nobody else.
I am not untested!
Not anymore, you're not. Because I'm testing you. Here's my test. You can run, or you can die. I not fault you for running. You wouldn't be the first Imperial to abandon his post. Some of you are finally figuring out you lost the war, and you're just clinging to debris. It's okay. You can go, and they won't ever find you.
Jom steps sideways, circling a bit closer to the officer and the gunnery console behind him.
Go ahead.
I...
No judgment here, pal.
The officer lowers the gun, takes one ginger step forward, like someone easing across the surface of a frozen lake, moving slowly, lest the whole thing crack and shatter and dump them into the hoarfrost depths. Jom thinks,
well, that went better than expected.
But then a look crosses the young officer's face. Another flash of fear. But this time it's different. A greater fear. A fear of his own people and what they'll do to him if he runs. The officer makes a decision in that moment. He raises the blaster anew. But by the time it's up, Jom is already charging forward like a bull. He slams into the Imperial, lifting both of them off the ground and slamming the young officer back onto the console. The young officer goes still and rolls off onto the ground. He curls up, moaning. Jom takes the blaster pistol, picks up the kid, and shoves him in a footlocker trunk toward the back.
Should have made a different choice, kid,
Jom says, then slams the trunk down. Inside, the officer yells and weeps. Jom winces and sits at the console. He pulls up radar. One ship. Incoming. He taps on it. The data cascades across a trio of screens in front of him. It's a yacht. A Ryuni Tantine Vitaliner. Fancy ship, if a little old, for the richest in the galaxy. What Jom and his friends used to call the Upper Atmos. Because on his world, Juntar, the richest of the rich used to live up in the sky, in these floating mansions, while the rest of the world toiled on the farms and in the dirt cities below. The yacht is from an older day. Clone Wars era. A day of greater pomp and circumstance. It's got a trajectory toward the palace. He checks its signature, because somehow it's made it through the blockade. And sure enough, the code that flashes checks out. It's an Imperial code, which makes that an Imperial ship. Jom chuckles and spins up the cannons. He pulls out the manual controls and tilts the two barrels of the massive turret toward the yacht. The ship coming in low and slow. Out of the clouds, its side is gleaming in the sun, like a sheen of liquid light. Jom grins and winks.
Bye-bye, little ship.
He pulls the twin triggers. Nothing happens. Pull, pull, pull. Nothing. Frag it, he bellows. Slamming the officer into the console must have damaged something. He watches the yacht ease toward the palace, safe as a star whale in an empty ocean.
No, no, no.
He has to fix this thing, and he has to fix it now. Because he's taking out that ship one way or another.
Chapter 33.
The very simple plan is this. They find their way to the entrance into the satrap's palace. It's obvious enough. It's not sealed with some inelegant crumble of rock and stone, but rather with the finest brick. Blood-red bricks embedded with flecks of lucrite. A semi-precious stone that glitters and flashes when light touches it. Upon the brick is a sign, in ornate script. Sealed by the authority of the satrapy of Mira Akiva. Then they move down the hall, just around the bend. And there, they wait. The officers will come past, likely with a handful of stormtroopers or palace guards in tow. And once past, they will have a surprise waiting. Nora's not sure about this. She hunkers down behind a pile of mossy rubble and leans back toward Jazz.
You're sure this will work?
No,
Jazz says.
I'm never sure, but this is our best bet.
We won't be able to take them all.
Among the four of us, I trust in our abilities, particularly with my skills and the droid's programming. We will be just fine.
To Temin, Nora says,
are you okay?
He nods, but he's not okay. She can see that. Something is bothering him.
He tries wearing a confident, even cocky mask, giving her that wry smile of his. But it's false. She's his mother, so she knows. Something is eating at him, chewing him up from the inside out. He's afraid, maybe. But is that all? He's usually so fearless. This feels like something else. No time to find out now. She hears something. To her son and the bounty hunter, she raises a finger to her lips and then mouths the words, "They're coming." Moments pass, and as they do, confusion and then horror settle into her. Because what she's hearing isn't from the direction of the sealed portal. It's from the other direction. It's coming from behind them. A faint shudder to the ground. Footsteps coming closer and closer.
"The Uktin,"
Jez says, and jacks a slug into her rifle.
"No,"
Nora says.
"I know that sound.
It's not the mad scramble of those wretched things. The Uktin swarmed with scrape of metal and machine walls. This is a measured step. The clatter of armor, not of repurposed droid limbs.
"Stormtroopers," Nora says.
And down the long, cragged passage behind them, she sees the first flash of white armor. A red laser bolt punctures the air just above their heads. A spray of stone and debris. Nora fires back. And then suddenly, the air is peppered with streaks of light.
"Fall back,"
Nora says. They have only one fallback position. Back toward the sealed gateway into the palace.
A dead end.
But what choice do they have? They pull back around the corner, and as they do, she tries to get a quick count of what's coming. A dozen or more stormtroopers. A tough fight, but maybe doable. Maybe. They round the corner, just as the gateway detonates. Crimson bricks clatter against the wall as the explosion eradicates the barrier. Through the dark haze of smoke and dust, more flashes of white. Stormtroopers pouring in from that end, too. Now they're trapped on both sides, caught like a rat between two cats. It hits her then. A sinking feeling as she realizes Sinjir sold them out. They're caught at the corner, hunkering down next to one another. She and Temin firing in one direction. Jazz and the droid, Bones with a blaster in his claw-like grip too, firing in the other. A voice cuts through the hellstorm. "Put your weapons down!" A woman's voice. The look on Jazz's face is a lightning strike of sheer rage. A mask of fury and murderous determination. "Eat slugs!" she barks, and raises her long-barreled rifle again. But Nora puts a hand on her shoulder. Jazz looks, a confusing stare, pleading in its own way.
"Let me kill them,"
it says. But Nora shakes her head and drops her weapon.
"Nora!"
Jazz says.
"You can't claim the bounty if you're dead," she answers.
"I'm so sorry,"
Temin says. The woman's voice calls out again.
"Weapons down! Stand up with your hands up! Move slowly!"
Jazz curses in a tongue Nora doesn't know, then lays her rifle down. Temin's blaster is already down, and he tells Bones to do the same. They stand, hands up. Stormtroopers emerge through the haze, a dozen on each side of them. Too many to take, even with a skilled bounty hunter and psychopathic battle droid on their side. Nora's insides twist up. Through the stormtroopers on the palace side, a woman, the one who commanded them to lay down their weapons, it seems, walks through her soldiers and toward the four. Her hands are clasped behind her back. The woman has dark eyes and skin, and her face is pursed into a dissecting stare. Her back has an arch to it, and her posture is one of authority and confidence. An admiral by the bars across her chest.
"I'm Admiral Ray Sloan," the woman says. "You are under arrest for conspiring against the Galactic Empire. Long may it reign."
Jazz curses again in an unknown tongue.
"Akiatolo Faruka!"
Then she spits on the ground.
"You'll never get away with this,"
Nora says. The end of the Empire is here. The comet is coming that will smash the rest of your rule to dust. Yes, well, the comet has not struck us yet, Nora Wexley. Come, for a short, very short while, you get to be guests of the satrapy of Akiva.
Jom lies down underneath the console. Wires dangle in his face like the face tentacles of a Quarren dentist. He ties off one wire, then pairs another two together. It sparks! And he curses. He fights desperately to bypass the trigger mechanism, which must be broken, and allow firing control to route right to the console itself. He ignores the pinprick burns on his face, and he tries the third wire. Above him, he hears a hum. The console is back on! That did it! Yes! He bites the inside of his cheek to distract from the pain as he hauls himself back to standing. Then he again aims the cannons. Now the yacht has landed at the palace. Well, no, not exactly. It can't land, not now. The landing ring is a mess. Even from here, he can see that the whole thing leans at a bad angle and looks as fragile as a house of Pazok cards. So the yacht hovers, burning fuel and staying aloft just nearby. It gives him a clear shot. He takes it. Jom finds the button to which he rerouted the firing mechanism. A button once used to just turn the lights on and off inside the turret, and smashes it with his thumb. Nothing happens. He roars in frustration and presses it again. The console lights up bright, then too bright, and then sparks crackle out of the sides and seams, and then the whole thing goes dark. Nora is forced to her knees on the palace floor.
A beautiful floor. A cerulean blue like she's never seen before, shot through with veins of copper and bronze. It has the look of seawater catching sunlight. And part of her wants to stare down at it forever and ever, pretending that none of this is happening. But it is happening. Sinjir has sold them out. They are captives. Their mission has failed, and they will be imprisoned or executed.
Despite her best desires, Nora isn't the type to turn away from what's coming, no matter how terrible. She lifts her chin and meets it, scowling. Next to her, Temin and Jazz kneel too. The droid remains standing, warily pivoting his head around, looking at all those who surround them. Every time his skull turns on its axis, she hears its little servo motors whine. She thinks,
"The droid is scattered, upset, unpredictable."
She whispers to her son,
"Control your droid."
But Temin just looks ashen. He says nothing.
The Admiral paces alongside them. At the top of a set of grand steps stands others of import. Nora sees a tall, fox-faced man in a dark Moff's uniform, and a smaller, older woman. That must be the General Jilia Shale. Behind them, a round-bellied, rubicund man with a wispy beard, and another individual in a tall, pompous hat. That one has a strangely beatific smile. Ray gives a nod to someone. Through the crowd, they bring Sinjir. His eye is swollen shut. His nose plugged with blood, and the bridge of it looks scabbed over, maybe even broken. Sinjir's hands are bound behind his back. They shove him forward, and he lands hard against his shoulder with an oof.
Sinjir?
Nora says. I don't understand.
Stormtroopers approach with magnacuffs.
"Let me free, Master Temin!"
Bone says, his astromech arm starting a slow whir.
Temin, in a small voice, says,
"No, Bones. No."
A trooper grabs roughly for Nora's arms, yanking them back. The cuffs snap around her wrist. They grab for Jazz, too, and she fights a little, yanking her shoulders away and growling like a feral beast. But that small act of defiance isn't enough. The shackles hum and snap around her wrists.
Temin, though, he stands up.
"Temin!"
Nora says. Son, this isn't the time. But he ignores her and steps forward. Stranger still, nobody stops him.
Let me go,
he says.
Me, my mother, and the droid.
Jazz says,
Oh no. Demin, no.
The sound in her voice, disappointment. Nora doesn't get it at first, but then Temin says,
That's the deal. Honor the deal.
Ray holds up a small holoscreen. She taps a button, and a projection emits. There stands a flickering blue hologram of a Sullustan with one eye.
She knows who that is. That is Surat Nuat.
Your deal with him, Sloane says, and the Sullustan smiles. The projection of Surat speaks.
Regrettably, boy, the Empire has negotiated their own deal, and they have changed their terms.
No! Temin says. You said we could go free!
Temin? Nora says, and she hears the terror in her voice. This can't be true. He couldn't have. He wouldn't. Temin! What's going on? He shoots her a look, sad and panicked.
I'm sorry.
From the floor, Sinjir groans.
He sold us out.
I wanted to stay here, Temin says. I didn't want to leave. This is my home. I had to give Surat something or he'd kill us. Mom, please.
Then to the Admiral.
No, this wasn't what we said. The deal was for me, my mom, my droid. We all get to go.
You may go, Ray says. The others remain. Unless you'd like to stay behind as well. I'm flexible on how tight we tie this noose.
Surat chuckles. Jazz looks at the boy and says,
You'd make a good bounty hunter, kid.
He'd make an even better Imperial, Sinjir says.
Temin rattled now beyond measure, wheels on his droid.
Bones! Save us!
And the droid utters a mechanized war whoop and leaps up!
The battle droid never had a chance. Laser fire cuts the metal man down in midair. The V1 droid screams and lands hard on his ground. So hard he shatters the blue and bronze tile. His legs go out from under him, and he slams onto his side as Temin races to him. Stormtroopers shove the boy out of the way and then hold him back. Nora tries to get to her feet, but they hold her there. She watches with inevitability as Sloane steps over to the droid. She draws her blaster and fires round after round into the machine's head. After the sixth shot, it pops off and spins away, smoking. The droid's limbs go still, clunking to the ground. Temin weeps.
As was our deal, you may go, Sloane says to the boy. To the stormtroopers holding him,
Escort him out of the palace! By way of the roof, if you please.
No!
Nora launches herself up and starts to run toward Temin. A flash of white behind her as a stormtrooper steps in and clubs her in the back with the butt of his blaster rifle. She goes down amid broken droid parts. Sinjir lies nearby. She cries out as they carry Temin away, the boy kicking and screaming and calling for his mother.
Chapter 34.
What have I done?
That thought runs on an endless loop inside Temin's head.
Guilt cuts through him like the vibroblade at the end of Mr. Bones' arm. The memory of the droid's destruction joins his guilty thought. That, his mother crying for him, the look on the faces of Jazz and Sinjir. At the time, it seemed like the right move. He knew he never wanted to leave Mira, but that meant making peace with Surat or finding his own tongue cut out of his head. So he went and made a call to Surat, and the Sullustan gangster took the deal. Temin excused it that the ex-Imperial and the bounty hunter would do the same. They'd sell his skin soon as someone offered enough credits, he said to himself.
They don't have any scruples. They don't have a code.
But it turns out, he was the one without scruples. Temin is the one without a code. He hoped against hope that it would all fall apart, and he wouldn't have to go through with it. That it would all work itself out, and the snare he'd tied around his own stupid leg would just untie itself. The knots going loose as the whole situation resolved itself without his plan coming to fruition.